Robert McClure. In tonight's news, UW students have reconstructed their solidarity encampment after they clashed with a wave of police early this morning.
A professor who was on the front lines and detained by police shares his story and explains why he returned to the scene.
The Mount Horeb community is in shock after an active shooter threat was averted outside the community's middle school.
And in the second half, more insight into life as a music therapist, the true story of the first Mifflin Street block party, and the most in-depth weather report on the airwaves.
So stay tuned, but first we'll go live to London for news from around the world from the BBC.
Hello, I'm David Harper with the BBC News. Thousands of demonstrators outside Georgia's parliament are refusing to disperse despite police using tear gas and water cannon. They are protesting against the provisional approval of a bill that critics say could silence dissent. The Foreign Agents Law requires organisations to state whether they are funded from abroad. The BBC's Rehan Dimitri says the mood is defiant.
Over the last couple of hours, the protests continued and it continues now. It's a really, really big crowd. Thousands, I don't know, maybe tens of thousands. And they're mainly young people. The police have already used repeatedly pepper sprays and water cannons, but people are refusing to disperse. So they're moving out of the area if they're being hit by the tear gas and then going back.
Riot police in the U.S. state of Texas have broken up an encampment of students protesting against the war in Gaza. The University of Texas at Dallas had told the demonstrators to leave, accusing them of breaching trespass laws. A short while ago, our correspondent Tom Bateman sent this update.
Tensions have really escalated. There was a very peaceful protest when we showed up. People were singing and chanting. The protesters were then handed a written note from the university administration telling them that they were breaching criminal trespass laws, and if the tents weren't removed, that they would be forcibly taken down and people risked arrest. And we then saw the state troopers, riot police armed with batons. They moved in waves towards the crowd. There have been some barricades placed by some of the protesters, and the police forced their way through and ripped down the tents and the gazebos.
Senators in the U.S. state of Arizona have voted to repeal a 19th century state law banning abortion unless the mother's life is in danger. The bill was revived after the U.S. Supreme Court overturned the constitutional right of women to a termination. It will be replaced by a law which prohibits abortions after 15 weeks, with no exceptions for rape or incest. Manhattan's district attorney says the disgraced Hollywood film producer Harvey Weinstein will be retried in New York after having his 2020 rape conviction overturned on appeal last week. Weinstein's conviction was seen as a historic milestone for the Me Too movement. Neda Taufik reports.
Harvey Weinstein, wearing a navy blue suit and a light blue tie, was brought into the courtroom in a wheelchair. His lawyer said he was suffering serious medical issues, but was sharp as a tack. The disgraced movie mogul will remain in custody in New York until he is retried, which the judge said could happen in September. Prosecutors said they still had confidence in their case. They appeared in court with Jessica Mann, one of the two women who helped put Weinstein in jail in the New York case, and said she was there to show that she's not backing down and that while Weinstein may have power and privilege, she has the truth.
BBC News. The U.S. Federal Reserve has announced that it is keeping interest rates at the highest level in more than two decades as inflation continues to hamper the U.S. economy. Officials have said they want more certainty that inflation is under control before they lower borrowing costs. The U.S. Special Envoy for Sudan says there is an urgent need for the warring sides there to take part in the proposed peace talks in Saudi Arabia. Tom Perriello urged countries in the region to use their leverage to get the Sudanese army and the paramilitary rapid support forces to end the war. Apple says it's trying to fix a problem that's causing some iPhone alarms to remain silent. It's unclear how many people have been affected by the fault, which has led users to oversleep. Some have been complaining on social media about their unexpected lie-ins. Apple says it's aware of the problem, but has not explained what's causing it. The celebrated rock guitarist Duane Eddy has died. He was 86. The Grammy-winning artist was one of the founding fathers of rock and roll. David Sillitoe has this report.
Duane Eddy, Peter Gunn, and the twang. His utterly distinctive guitar style. The sound, he said, was an echo of where he grew up. Desolate, arid Arizona.
Something about the guitar and the sound of it and everything, it just kind of smacks of the Southwest and the wide open spaces.
He had a run of hits in the 50s and 60s. In the 80s, The Art of Noise took him back into the charts, and his final album was recorded in his 70s with Sheffield's Richard Hawley, a long-time admirer, who said one note from that Gretsch guitar was all you needed to hear to know you are listening to Duane Eddy.
David Sillitoe looking back at the life of the celebrated rock guitarist Duane Eddy. Live from London, that's the latest BBC News.
This is Amy Owen and Rob McClure with your local news, coming to you from the WORT studios on Bedford Street in beautiful downtown Madison. Here are tonight's headlines. Former President Donald Trump hit the campaign trail in Wisconsin today, taking a day off from his hush money trial in New York. Visiting the Waukesha County Expo Center, Trump took aim at President Joe Biden's handling of the economy and immigration, saying, quote, "Biden came in and unleashed mayhem on our economy, just like he unleashed mayhem on our border," unquote. Trump's visit comes as he is in the middle of a criminal trial, where he is accused of falsifying business records to cover up an affair. Trump was fined $9,000 and held in contempt of court yesterday for violating the gag order multiple times, which prohibits him from discussing the trial publicly. The former president was warned by the judge that he could face jail time if he continues to violate the gag order. Meanwhile, Trump and current President Biden are neck and neck in recent polling, the difference between them within the margin of error for the poll itself. According to the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, some of Trump's supporters interviewed at the Waukesha rally said they would still vote for Trump even if he were convicted. One supporter called Trump, quote, "honest to a fault," unquote, and referred to the criminal charges against him as, quote, "show trials," unquote.
Congress has voted to remove or delist gray wolves from the national roster of endangered species. Gray wolves were nearly extinct by the 1960s and have since rebounded to an estimated 1,000 wolves now. The bill to delist the wolves was authored by Representative Lauren Boebert of Colorado and Wisconsin's own Congressman Tom Tiffany of Northern Wisconsin. The vote on the bill was largely a party line vote, with all Democrats but four voting against and all Republicans but four voting in favor. Senator Tammy Baldwin has supported a similar bill that would delist the wolf.
Illinois has been one of 14 states in the U.S. without a Native American tribe with federal recognition, but that is about to change, thanks to a collaborative effort to restore nearly 1,300 acres of reservation to a tribe in DeKalb County in northern Illinois. The Prairie Band of the Potawatomi Nation has been trying to reclaim their land since it was auctioned off illegally by the U.S. government 175 years ago. Now, parts of the Prairie Band's Shabani Reservation, totaling 1,280 acres, will be placed in a federal trust for the band. This will shield the land from local taxes and jurisdiction, confirm the land as a, quote, "Indian county," unquote, and ensure the nation's sovereignty over the land, according to a statement released by the Prairie Band.
Amtrak announced today that they are doubling their planned service between the Twin Cities and Chicago, adding a second train to the route that also runs through Milwaukee. Amtrak Borealis will begin service in just under 3 weeks, offering coach and business class seats. Coach fares start at $41 each way from St. Paul to Chicago, and with discounted tickets for some people. The trip from St. Paul to Chicago takes about 7.5 hours and includes 8 stops in Wisconsin. According to Amtrak's statement, the additional train service will lead to greater travel across the Midwest, contributing to economic growth across the region.
A Manitowoc County judge rejected the motion to change the $15,000 cash bond for Katrina Bauer yesterday. Bauer was arrested after her 3-year-old child, Elijah Vu, went missing in February. Bauer faces a slew of felony and misdemeanor charges, ranging from child neglect to lying to the police about her child's whereabouts prior to being reported missing. The motion to the court was to change Bauer's cash bond to a signature bond, which would not have required any money to grant Bauer's release from custody. According to the Herald Times reporter, Judge DeWayne of Manitowoc County decided that there were too many unanswered questions to justify granting a signature bond for Bauer.
A buyer has been found for Madison's two troubled apartment complexes, one on Rethke Terrace off of East Washington Avenue, the other on Tree Lane near Westtown. The two buildings, with a total of 105 apartments, were constructed to house individuals and families who were experiencing homelessness. The previous owner of the buildings, Heartland Partners of Chicago, was unable to operate the properties and were the subject of numerous police calls and disturbances. The new owner of the building, Sinair Solutions, purchased the buildings for $1. They will also receive up to $7 million in grants and loans from city, county, and state agencies, according to the Wisconsin State Journal. And those were this evening's headlines. Now on to the rest of the day's top stories.
Early this morning, just before 7 a.m., police from several agencies marched into the Gaza Solidarity Encampment on UW-Madison's Library Mall. There, they surrounded student demonstrators, took most tents in the encampment, and made almost 36 arrests. But this afternoon, the encampment was already back on its feet. WORT News producer Faye Parks has more.
Officers from a variety of state and local departments, including UW-Madison Police, the Madison Police Department, the Dane County Sheriff, and the State Patrol, marched onto the encampment at Library Mall early this morning. Mia Kurzer, one of the demonstrators, was there.
We were sitting, we weren't doing anything wrong, we weren't blocking anything, we weren't causing any disruptions, we were peaceful, and the police just came in here with riot gear and they started just going at the crowd, and people got hurt, people got arrested for just being on a public space, being in a public property.
Over the next 2 hours, police arrested dozens of people and removed dozens more tents. At the end, two tents still stood. Of the 34 people arrested, ranging from students to faculty to community members, most were released with no citation issued, according to a statement from UW-Madison Police. One demonstrator, who spoke to WORT but declined to be recorded or give their name, said they were processed in the basement of Memorial Union Theater. They said they were told not to return to Library Mall today, or else they would face arrest. UW Gender and Women's Studies professor Sammy Schock was one of several people today to be assaulted and detained. Online video footage shows State Patrol officers choking her. In a tweet, she shares that her injuries required a hospital visit and resulted in a sprained shoulder and possible internal damage. Samer Alatut, professor of Community and Environmental Sociology, was also injured and detained. He told WORT the details of his experience just minutes after the fact. But not all faculty supporting the encampment were arrested. Linda Berry is a professor in UW-Madison's art department. She arrived on Library Mall just as police were leaving the scene, but stayed on site to support her students.
One of my former students, got hit by one of the shields and had a little laceration on her hand, and that made me start shaking. You know, it's one thing when you watch this stuff on TV, it's another thing when it's your own students who are being harmed. So that was very upsetting.
Four people were booked into the Dane County Jail. Two demonstrators have been charged with battery to a police officer, one demonstrator with battery to a police officer and resisting arrest, and another demonstrator charged with attempting to disarm a police officer, resisting arrest, and attempted escape. Three deputies from Dane County were injured, according to a statement, and a state trooper was injured when a protester struck their head with a skateboard. Over the past few days, UW administrators, led by Chancellor Mnookin, have maintained that they support free expression and peaceful protest. In a statement released today, UW administration said demonstrators were warned of consequences before police encroached, and they pointed to the, quote, illegal activity, unquote, of tents overnight. administration has repeatedly pointed to a section of state law governing UW campuses that explicitly bans the pitching of tents or the overnight use of sleeping bags. The statement also goes on to express support for civil disobedience, but only within the confines of following the law. A part of the statement reads, quote, "It is a long-standing element of the civil disobedience tradition to respect the laws we share and to accept that there are consequences for violating them," unquote. An anonymous demonstrator told WORT this afternoon,
"Political speech is allowed by the First Amendment, but the university only cracks down on it depending on its content."
Today's crackdown comes after Governor Evers warned yesterday that the student encampments at UW-Madison and UW-Milwaukee have to end at some point, voluntarily or not. Mia Kurzer, a demonstrator, told WORT Today that she canvassed for Evers during his campaign.
"But I do think it's a little disappointing to see people in power take the side of the people who are causing violence to our students."
This morning, Assembly Speaker Robin Voss applauded the crackdown and thanked Chancellor Mnuchin for enforcing campus policies and, quote, "standing up to the unruly mob," unquote. In a separate tweet, Voss praised free speech and the right to protest, but said camping out on state property didn't qualify as free speech. Just after 9 this morning, police retreated to other campus buildings, including Memorial Union and the Pyle Center. Demonstrators followed, heckling officers and cheering at their departure. At the encampment, two tents remained standing, but by 11 a.m., more tents had already sprung up, most of them donations from supporters.
"We are here and committed to staying here in solidarity with Gaza and solidarity with student protesters all across the country. And we won't leave until the chancellor meets our demands."
Meanwhile, the solidarity encampment at UW-Milwaukee has seen a limited police presence and remains untouched as of this afternoon. Reporting for WORT News, I'm Faye Parks. Shelley Pittman contributed reporting.
Today's police response to the peaceful encampment at UW-Madison resulted in injuries all around for students, faculty, and police officers. Two UW faculty are confirmed to have been arrested and assaulted by police. Sociology professor Samer Al-Tu and gender and women's studies professor Sammy Schalk both command significant online followings and have been outspoken about their support for the student protest. Online footage shows both being manhandled by police. WORT has received unconfirmed reports of several more faculty having similar experiences. Just after police retreated this morning, we managed to catch up with Professor Al-Tu, who was bruised and sporting band-aids covering wounds on his shoulder, nose, and hand. Al-Tu told our news director, Shali Pittman, about his experience and why he was there in support of the students. He says he was explicitly targeted and asserted that people of color bore the brunt of today's police violence. It was windy this morning, so you'll need to excuse the extra noise in the microphone.
Yeah, I'm Samer Al-Tu'ut, S-A-M-E-R-A-L-A-T-O-U-T. And I'm the Bottle Sewell Professor, Associate Professor in Community and Environmental Sociology.
And you look a little beaten up this morning.
Yes.
Tell me what happened.
I was with faculty and staff locking hands, trying to protect the students from the physical aggressive move by the police. And they targeted me. They said, "We want him, get him, grab him." And so they charged at me and kicked me to the ground several times. And I would stand up and they would kick my heel. In the process, they did injure me and they hit me, I don't know with what else, but the shields definitely several times and part of it in the head. Yeah, I mean, that's what happened.
So I noticed you have a band-aid on your forehead and on your nose.
Yes, and on my hand, yeah. I think this hand probably scraped on the ground, but these are from the shields. They took me in and they processed me, kind of.
And, where did they do that?
In Memorial Union. And so, you know, I waited. They they processed me and they gave me a citation. I don't know what the citation is exactly. I think resistance, which is absolutely false, because I wasn't resisting. I was insisting on holding on to my responsibility as a faculty member. And that responsibility, which is first and foremost, from my perspective, is about protecting students' intellectual, mental, psychological, and physical, from physical harm. And I do that all the time, proudly, and I take it really seriously. And so in this case, I take seriously my role as a professor, that I will protect my students, and by students, I mean all of the students in the institution, to express themselves, but also especially from physical harm. So this was a moment of solidarity with the students, a moment of, I mean, I wish it didn't come to that level, to that degree of violence, but the students did not do that. The students were peaceful in the last couple of days. There were art workshops, there were music, there was food, there was, the students are from every single faith that you can find. They are from every country you can find. It was a celebratory moment. These 2 days, there was a lot of connection and identification and relating and becoming really kin with one another, like creating a basis for kinship. And so to have the administration all of a sudden militarizing this beautiful expression of speech and freedom of speech and stuff is really hurting, in so many different ways, and physically is one of them, yeah.
I've noticed that there are a couple different police departments out here. I saw at least the Dade County Sheriff and the State Patrol, and I'm assuming others like UW, Madison, and City, working on that. But can you tell me who processed you and what that detention was like?
Mine, I think it was UW. To tell you the truth, I didn't even pay attention. But I think UWPD.
Yeah. And just tell me more, like, were there other people with you when you were detained?
There were a lot of students. They put them on the other side of the room, away from me. But I don't know why they did that, but I spoke with the students, like, loudly, kind of screaming at them, trying to make them feel supported, and they are not alone. And I hope they heard that and felt it.
These students, would you say, and how many faculty?
I mean, at the time, there wasn't many, because I was the first, I think I was the first person, or maybe first one of the first couple of people who were arrested. So there were, like, maybe by the end, at the end, when I got out from there, there were about maybe 15, 20. Also, one of the things that I think is really important to report on is how racialized the move was. So, I mean, they moved on me first, and I'm a professor of color. I'm Palestinian American. I'm the only Palestinian American professor who is kind of involved in the kind of governance of the faculty and staff around this issue.
I saw Dr. Sammy Shaw.
Yeah, and Dr. Sammy Shaw, and they turned it into a racialized kind of attack, and from the very beginning, I mean, you can see that a lot of the students who were arrested were non-whites, and a lot of the professors, I think, standing for the right of the students to express themselves, and then standing with them when they are going through physical violence is really important. And I take it really seriously. So I think faculty and staff and the administration should walk the walk, right? They cannot just talk about how valuable the students are and then unleash a violent force at them, right? Especially Palestinian students and even Muslim and Arab students or students who are, you know, they felt for the last 5 months that they have been marginalized. I mean, I cannot speak on their behalf. They can tell you, but they have been telling the administration how they felt. And this is part of what led to this. So it's the fault of the university not opening up the channels of communication with those students, because they have been trying, right? I mean, you know, worries. I mean, the only worry I have is my kids seeing me today and probably on social media, probably they already saw it, probably. They are in school. But, you know, I mean, that probably is. And also the psychological trauma, kind of, you know, the Palestinian-American professor who has been subjected to settler colonial violence in Palestine in the past, comes here and gets treated and subject to the same settler colonial system of violence. So that's a psychological scar, kind of, you know. I mean, I really seriously, I mean, I know that sometimes people think that it's a hyperbole, that professors actually feel genuinely about their students with love and affection and connection. And I think they should understand, I mean, people in general should understand that those feelings are not hyperbole, and it's not a lie, it's not camouflaging other agenda. It's genuine understanding that the students are our people, and they are smart, and they are funny, and they are good, and that they will lead us into a different future, and that's our hope. And so we have to all kind of celebrate them wherever we can, and I think that's what drives me in the end. And regardless of it's pro-Palestine or not, I mean, even if it's pro-Israel, I probably, if it comes down to the police going to hit the students, I probably will do the same thing.
Earlier today, schools in the village of Mount Horeb, 20 minutes west of Madison, were locked down after an active shooter threat outside the school. No students or educators were harmed, though students continued to be locked down past the end of the normal school day. WORT reporter David Ahrens has the wrap-up.
Earlier today, an active shooter was, in the words of the Dane County Sheriff's Department, neutralized outside of the Mount Horeb Middle School. At the first reports of sighting an individual with a rifle, all schools were locked down. The shooter did not enter the middle school and was reportedly shot by police outside the school. It's not known if the suspect is dead. At the time of the shooting, children were playing outside. One eighth grader told Wisconsin Public Radio that when he heard his teacher yell, he ran out of the schoolyard with his friends, and they hid in a neighbor's basement. Parents and families of the middle school were directed to report to two local churches. Other schools remained on lockdown, stretching into this afternoon, with police saying they would release students in stages during their investigation. The police response to the sighting of a possible shooter was enormous, with dozens of vehicles from the state and local police departments. One parent, waiting for her child, told WISC-TV, quote, "I just want my kid. They're supposed to be safe in school, in Mount Horeb of all places," unquote. In a Facebook post this afternoon, the village of Mount Horeb described the situation as, quote, "horrifying." The post continued, praising the response from the school district, Mount Horeb police and fire departments, and county emergency responders, along with area businesses who, quote, "provided a safe space for students to shelter in place while events were unfolding." The situation prompted a wave of responses from elected leaders. State Representative Mike Baer said in a statement that he's grateful to the first responders who provided aid and comfort to the community and offered any assistance needed by community leaders. Dane County Executive Joe Parisi described today as a day that won't be forgotten, adding, quote, "moments like this turn lives upside down, cause trauma, sorrow, and a moment of reflection for all of us," unquote. no other person other than the alleged assailant was physically hurt today. But according to the nationwide analysis from Education Week, there have been more than 13 school shootings around the country in 2024, which have caused 22 injuries and 4 deaths. The most recent school shooting happened 1 week ago when an 18-year-old student was shot and killed at James Bowie High School in Arlington, Texas, just before dismissal. Reporting for WORT News, I'm David Ahrens.
And breaking news on this story, Attorney General Josh Call and Mount Horeb School District Superintendent Steve Salerno are slated to hold a media briefing tonight in Mount Horeb.
And you're listening to Handcrafted Local News here on WORT. Stay with us for the second half. There's a lot more coming at you. We'll hear about life as a music therapist. We will travel back in time to 1969, and we'll travel forward to this coming weekend and see what's happening in the weather in every possible detail you can imagine.
But now we'll take a quick break. Back in a flash.
I feel lucky. I feel lucky. Yeah.
Wartstock is coming to Warner Park on Sunday, May 19th, and we're holding a raffle with some great prizes. Winners will take home one of 5 Summer Music Festival weekend passes, and we've added dinner for 6 with tequila tastings at Migrants, worth over $700, a pair of season passes to Forward Theater, stays from Marquette and Ruby Marie Hotels, and a crystal and onyx necklace from Goodman's Jewelers. Gift certificates from Sardine, Orange Tree Imports, 10 Pin Alleys, and much, much more. Plus, merch from Wine and Hop Shop, and of course, some great wart swag. Tickets are $3 each, 2 for 5 and 5 for 10. Drawing is at 5 p.m. at Wartstock, but you do not need to be present to win. Tickets are available at upcoming wart events or at the station. A complete list of prizes is on our website at wartfm.org. Good luck.
I feel lucky today.
WORT thanks its listener sponsors and Five Nines, a locally owned cloud service provider of enterprise-level IT infrastructure consulting, hosting, and management services. On the web at 59s.com. Phone number 512-1000.
The time is now 6:33, and you're listening to the live local news on WORT. I'm your host, Robert McClure, here with my co-host, Amy Owen. Thanks for staying with us.
There are many moving parts in the orchestra that is our healthcare industry. On this week's Madison's Backbone, feature contributor Riley Cutright has more of her conversation with Grace, a music therapist. Grace says her field is gaining respect in the medical field, and that music therapy is far more than just individualized entertainment.
A community is a unified body of individuals sharing something in common. Over a quarter of a million people call Madison, Wisconsin their home. Have you ever wondered about the secret to Madison's vibrant and unique community? Well, I have the answer for you. Workers. This segment features the working voices who undeniably strengthen and brighten Madison's community on the daily. I'm Riley Cutright, and this is Madison's Backbone. This week on Madison's Backbone, we're jumping right back in with Grace, who's a music therapist. Do you think you and other people in your profession get enough recognition?
It's so interesting because I feel like, and I don't know if it's just because I've gotten to work in populations that where music therapy is becoming more standard and highly desired. Because hospice is a high desired, or like most hospice companies are hiring music therapists right now. So, and in nursing homes, they're recognizing hospice music therapists pretty easily. Similarly with children, I worked mostly with kids that were on the autism spectrum, and that has become kind of a bigger, and at least in Wisconsin with funding sources, like it is becoming better recognized, but it is frustrating. And it's like, okay, a music therapist would really benefit in like, you know, a rehabilitation center where you're like having somebody who's recovering from a stroke and they're like not making these breakthroughs in speech, speech therapy or OT or something like that, but they need rhythm or something to like supercharge their they're learning in their more common therapies that are insurance reimbursable. So it's frustrating where it's like, okay, music therapy is called in when it's like everything else has gone to crap rather than like used as this additional support in the midst of like general progression or care. Like, especially like with the kids I was working with on the waiver, it was a lot of families where nothing was working. And so the parents were just kind of, there was kind of this desperation of this, like, well, maybe music therapy will solve all the thing. And it's like, well, you can't just have one profession like happen and hope for the best. But like for a lot of other folks, like what if you did, you know, partial treatment or like co-treatment for a certain amount of time, and you could see that it would create greater engagement or empowerment in their other therapies just because there is that creative arts therapy element to it. And I can, a lot of music therapists get really burnt out, especially when they're in private practices and they're not demonstrating like solid clinical growth, or it's like difficult to quantify. And so like you have some families that are like, oh yeah, I can totally see the benefit of this because my child is creating a relationship with this provider, or because, you know, my 80-year-old mom is, you know, engaging in a way or using speech in a way that we haven't seen in, you know, since she's had this progression of dementia. But then you just have a lot of people where it's like, if they don't experience those like burst moments of like, yes, breakthrough or recognition or like empirical data, then they just get burnt out and feel like they're there to be entertainment and not there for their full clinical strength. But there have been like moments where it's like, oh, nothing else is working, so we're just going to try this one provider. And I'm like, well, what if you like kept the other providers in play and then we added or like collaborated, or just because it's just this. You're right. It isn't that like passing on or teamwork process, but it just feels like you're a miracle worker. Come in and do your job. And it's like, it doesn't work that way. Or if it is to work that way, I need to study up in like so many other domains right. to effectively use music to like have research that is backing what I'm doing. Like if I have a kid with really complex sensory processing, then I have to read on like, okay, what type of sensory processing are they struggling with? Is it that on top of a developmental disorder, or on top of an anxiety and this, that, or the other? And it's like, I'm not a child psychologist, so I can't do the diagnostician work and the treatment. Like, it's just not attainable. Well, and two, like, it is supposed, like, I think the hope is that it's accessible or that it's enjoyable and, like, very patient-directed and patient-centered. And so then it feels even less like it's going to get the job done or, like, it's going to be, you know, effective. But it's like, no, if you really have a patient empowered to like do their therapy, then you're not imposing something upon them. It's like this free expression and engagement that is actually going to lead to longer term growth.
How does your job impact your daily life?
Oh, so many ways. I think part of it is like, it is cool when you meet people and you're like, what do you do for work? And you say, I'm a music therapist. And they're like, well, that's so cool. And then you have to explain your job. I would say, like, as far as impacting my daily life, sometimes schedule is really weird, especially if you're working with children populations outside of a school setting, because you're accommodating towards these crazy hours. I know a lot of people that are working as, like, private business owners. It's that flexibility determining, like, how you set good boundaries to, and two, like, the anytime you're in that helping profession or, like, direct patient care, there's that thinking on your clients too. It's been a lot easier for me since I switched over to hospice, just because I think part of me knows that like they're in a nursing facility or there's like a full team that's working with them. So there's greater ease of mind. There's definitely that like ruminating brain over like the care of my kids or like their progress that sat with me more when I was working with that population.
How much do you think that your work impacts your community?
It's so interesting because, like, I think I would find the most enjoyment in a profession or in a job that was located in a facility or in an environment that is very, like, it is an existing community, because then I feel like there's that branching out. I find the most, like, energy when I get to do a session where a family member is present, and then it's that idea of, like, their micro community, which is their family system, is part of it, and can see like their loved one engaging in a way they haven't in a while or in a new way, like as a child especially was very powerful. So it's like I can see those like family connections, and I feel like that's an impact on community. But I feel like some music therapists still have a bit of a personality of like, oh, we're just misunderstood, and so we're going to feel like the community won't understand us or perceive us as, you know, entertainment or something like that. And my brain's always like, music belongs to everybody and every user, and whether or not it's utilized purely for recreation or for therapeutic purposes, like I think music is present in our communities and is therapeutic. Like, access to music and access to musical expression is part of our lifeblood as a society. I sometimes, when I feel like my work is small, I go, no, music in general should be impacting my micro and macro communities. And I play a part in that and getting to use it just to interrupt individual lives with using music for clinical purposes. And two, like, I don't know, my favorite moments have been, like, now that I'm back in hospice, I'm in nursing homes all the time. So you're in a nursing home, and nursing home environments, they try their best, but some are just kind of sad because there is, you know, if you don't have family that's really actively involved, or if you don't have the resources in that nursing home to, like, really build a joyful community, it's so funny how, like, bringing in a guitar and even, like, providing music and doing music therapy with one patient, like, choosing to do it in a day room instead of their bedroom, if it's appropriate, you're giving music to kind of a larger environment. And then this, like, brightening effect that happens in other patients or in the nursing staff, or, like, other people getting to see a resident engaging in music in a meaningful way, kind of uplifting so many other people. So that's one of my favorite things. Or when I was in the hospital too, it was cool to carry a guitar on your back and be like, nope, I get to interrupt this space that can be kind of heavy and bring levity, but bring kind of that expression and power to it too.
Do you have any tips on getting hired?
I think so much of it is just, like, applying for multiple jobs, seeing how you feel with different supervisors and interviewers. In music therapy, at least, there's a lot of private practices you can start out with, and that's typically a great, like, starting position. And then figuring out, okay, do I like this? It gives more of a clinical, like, a clean space, because you're only doing specific service, which is music therapy for specific clientele. So that I think was a really good start for me. But two, just, like, looking around and seeing what kind of environments you want to be in. So if you want to be in more of a community environment, like, thinking, okay, I could work in a nursing home. They might ask me to run activities or something like that. Is that something I'm willing to do? Or, like, am I okay with having less of a clean clinical focus, but then get to be in an environment that I enjoy in this facet or whatever? Like, every experience is just to build to something else has been something that's been really comforting and exciting for me too. So yeah, that's my meandering. Any tips though would be just to know your peeps. We have, like, professional organizations, so it's always been really helpful to, like, be connected with the Wisconsin chapter of music therapists. And each state has its own chapter, and then there's regional organizations and a national network too.
If you could give one tip or trick to help a new hire, what would it be?
Oh my goodness, one new tip or trick to help a new hire. I think what helped me most was, like, at least in, like, individual sessions, to know that, like, you're always interacting with a person who wants to engage in whatever way they can. So remembering that, like, music is intended to be accessible. My biggest tip was having an open-tuned guitar that I was okay with getting anything on. So I called it my yogurt guitar with the kids.
No!
we just Cloroxed that thing to no end, but it was nylon string. And it was, like, a great metaphor for me to remember, like, am I making my music accessible? Like, am I scared that this instrument is going to be hurt in a certain way, or that, you know, the tones of it have to be perceived or are going to be uncomfortable for someone to engage with, like, in multiple sensory realms? It's been a good reminder to me in my work to be like, is the music for me or is the music for my client? And is that present in the tools I'm using, in the way I'm approaching this person, in the environment I'm setting up, and just keeping that as my foothold of, like, it is not for me. It is for the person I'm with. Obviously, safety is important, but remembering yogurt guitars are essential to breaking down some of those barriers and letting people use music for what they need music for. If you're interested in music therapy or pursuing it as a career or contacting a music therapist, at least in Wisconsin, a great place to start is on the Wisconsin Chapter of Music Therapy website.
I'm Riley Cutright, and I'm here with Grace. And if nobody has thanked you today, thank you.
And on to the weather. Happy May Day, first of all. A tip of the hat to all the working folks out there that keep the country running. And it's also a pagan holiday, of course, too, marking the 3/8 point in the solar year. So what's not to like? And we can now look back at the month of April, and that was warmer than normal, just like every month so far this year. Only 2.7 degrees warmer than normal, though, so it was the least hot of the four hot months so far in 2024. As far as moisture is concerned, we were pretty much right on the normals for April, about a tenth of an inch short. Incidentally, our streak of warm monthly anomalies now goes all the way back to March of last year, so we're at 13 and counting, I'm afraid. May is going to start out in a similar vein. We hit 72 this afternoon. That was 8 degrees above normal. And a glance at the synoptic maps off the medium-range forecast models don't show any obvious dives below normal, at least out through the mid part of the month. There is a modest consensus that the upper Midwest may see something of a cool down towards the end of next week, but without any great amplification in the upper air pattern that might indicate an overnight freeze at that point. So if keep your fingers crossed, let's say, if you've got fruit trees or tender plants in the ground already. Have a look at the water vapor image of the contiguous U.S., which we have linked up at the top of the WORT weather webpage, and you'll see the quite amplified trough and ridge pattern from west to east across the continent and the upper air from this past weekend, transforming into a much more zonal configuration by the end of the three-day sequence there. Largely thanks to an easterly push of faster winds across about the 40th parallel, which cuts off any significant southward push of cold air behind this weekend or the Monday storm. That zonal jet did kick up its own little storm, which passed here last evening, but with most of its precipitation drying up before ever reaching ground level. That jet branch across the center of the country has now begun to buckle out to our west across the plains, helping again to kind of reassert the trough ridge pattern from this past weekend across the country in the upper air. The trough centered out roughly over the meridian about of, say, Idaho down through Utah and Arizona, is already in the process of spinning up a surface circulation, which you can see in the yellow isobars if you've got the image up over West Texas. And that will approach across Kansas and Iowa tomorrow. Gulf moisture will make a pretty good run on the area on the southerly winds out ahead of that low, but an easterly and southeasterly component to those winds north of the warm front up here is going to provide, once again, a significant amount of dry air at the low levels, at least through the nighttime hours, to stave off rain, I think until, say, the mid-morning hours of tomorrow. Warm frontal rains may then set in for a few hours in the midday, but if we were to clear especially later in the day with the warm front going past us to the north, we might get some decent thunderstorms as we get on towards evening. That possibility looks fairly low at this point, but worth mentioning. Showers and thunderstorms then should pass eastward overnight tomorrow with a lovely day then on Friday and Pacific high pressure pushing in behind a cold front. A second low pressure circulation with slightly colder air behind it will then pass eastward midday Saturday. The forecast models have been kind of drying out and scattering the showers that are thought to accompany that, but there's at least a modest threat of showers Saturday afternoon. Sunday again looks nice though. As for the details, tonight the skies will continue to see passing mid-level clouds, which will gradually thicken and lower through the nighttime hours, especially as we get on towards dawn tomorrow. Temperatures will drop to the low 50s on northerly winds at 4 to 8 miles per hour, veering northeast and east by dawn. Tomorrow will be breezy and cooler, with temperatures reaching the low to mid-60s, held down by cloud cover and showery precipitation during the midday. We may see some lifting of the cloud decks in the afternoon, probably with occasional showers still passing at times. Easterly winds at 10 to 17 miles per hour will veer southeast and eventually south late in the day. If we clear late in the day and warm up, say, towards 70 degrees, like I mentioned, we may get a good round or two of organized thunderstorms, possibly some strong ones. Otherwise, just additional showers and more run-of-the-mill thunderstorms with the passing of the cold front in the evening. Temperatures will drop to the mid-50s overnight as winds veer more west and northwest. And Friday will be breezy and generally clear with temperatures reaching 70 or so on northerly winds at 8 to 12 miles per hour. We'll drop into the 40s overnight on lighter, more northeasterly winds. And Saturday should start mostly sunny with increasing clouds in the midday or afternoon hours. Temperatures will reach the upper 60s on north and northeast winds at 4 to 8 miles per hour. Passing showers may wet up some spots in the mid or late afternoon, but I think with little in the way of accumulation. Temperatures will drop to the upper 40s overnight and then back to 70, or at least the upper 60s on Sunday, which will otherwise be clear. At the moment, at the station on Bedford Street here, it's 70 degrees outside. The dew point temperature is 30. Winds are out of the northwest at 12 miles per hour. Passing cirrus and some mid-level cloud cover up at about 15,000 feet, and the barometer is at 29.90 inches of mercury and fairly steady over the past few hours.
It's now 6:50 p.m., and you're listening to the live local news on WORT. It's now 6:51 p.m., and you're listening to the live local news on WORT. We go now to the first weekend of May 1969, when a block party became a three-night riot. Here's Stu Levitan with the true story of the Mifflin Street Block Party Riots, Part 1, on tonight's Madison in the 60s.
They melt into a dream.
Madison in the 60s, May 1969, the Mifflin Street Block Party Riots, Part 1. The flyers are posted around downtown on April 29th from a group calling itself the International Werewolf Conspiracy, its membership as mysterious as its name, advertising a party that Saturday in the 500 block of West Mifflin Street, in the heart of the student ghetto known as Miffland. The academic year is winding down, and they just want to get high and dance in the streets. The IWWC doesn't care that they don't have a permit. Lots of neighborhoods throw block parties without official sanction. Why, cops had even diverted traffic for a no-permit party on West Gilman Street just the week prior. But Miffland is the neighborhood radical leader Tom Hayden calls one of America's liberated zones, where the police aren't so friendly and helpful. And the poster's a bit provocative. The illustration mimics the man from the Zigzag Rolling Papers, except he's wearing a bandolero and calling for armed love and to off the pig. Police Chief Wilbur Emery schedules extra men for Saturday afternoon, and arranges with Sheriff Vernon Jack Leslie for 100 deputy sheriffs to be on standby. The chief does not consult with the new mayor, Bill Dyke, sworn in only 2 weeks earlier. Detective Tom McCarthy, one of several officers severely injured at the riot following the anti-Dow protest in October 1967, is looking forward to the weekend as a return engagement. "We're going to bring the war to Mifflin Street," he vows. On Saturday, May 3rd, organizers set up some speakers on the porch at 512 West Mifflin, and by 3 o'clock, a crowd of a few dozen is grooving to a Janis Joplin record Alison Claremont is playing. Then Police Inspector Herman Thomas, the department's number two man, shows up and tells Claremont to turn it down. She tells him to get a warrant. He pushes his way through the crowd and pulls the plug himself before relenting and letting the music stay on at a lower volume. But as soon as Thomas leaves, the volume returns, with dancers now spilling into the street. Officers cite the ban on block parties and push them back onto the sidewalk. Thomas is at the station, gathering 8 more officers in riot gear. "We're going down there to crack some skulls," he tells them, returning to the scene about 4:15. Thomas uses a squad car loudspeaker to order everyone off the street. The crowd responds with rocks and vulgar catcalls, and someone sticks a roasted pig's head near the car. Baton-wielding police start pushing into the crowd and making isolated arrests, including of Alderman Paul Soglin for failure to obey a lawful order, namely driving on the street they're supposedly trying to keep open. As his constituents watch in outrage, police pull Soglin out of his 1959 Triumph convertible and put him into their paddy wagon. Soglin had planned to follow the paddy wagon to the city-county building to find out who had been arrested. he is soon among their number. Before he's bailed out, jailers cut Soglin's hair. By 5 p.m., there are 30 officers, all but a handful in riot gear, arrayed down the middle of the street, and about 500 youth on lawns, porches, and roofs. A handful hurl rocks and bottles. Thomas later claims they even throw feces. Alderman Eugene Parks, elected a month earlier as Madison's first black alder, pleads in vain with Thomas to let the party go on. He tells the crowd to cool it while he appeals to Mayor Dyke and Chief Emery. But when Parks returns around 6, without being able to contact either, he's booed and jeered, and a smoke bomb is thrown to within a few feet of the squad car he's speaking from. As if by signal, more rocks fly. "Enough of this nonsense," Thomas declares, and unleashes his officers to disperse the crowd. He later says they could proceed, quote, "in whatever manner they saw fit." Shedding the restraint they showed during the Black Studies strike on campus in February, they charge with nightsticks up and are hit with a hail of rocks and bricks. Thomas deploys tear gas, withdraws his men for about an hour, and calls for county and university support. 122 more officers respond. For the next several hours, there's pandemonium as small affinity groups engage in hit-and-run battles with police, often in coordinated attacks and ambushes. A nearby building project provides a ready source for bricks. County deputies pump out massive amounts of tear gas with their new Smith & Wesson pepper fogger, spraying gas at a distance of up to 200 yards. A toxic cloud settles over the three flats. Sometimes police hurl tear gas canisters right inside, including into the Dayton Street apartment of radical history professor Harvey Goldberg. Two members of the Young Social Alliance liberate a flatbed truck and block the intersection of West Washington Avenue and North Bassett Street. With mattresses and furniture, it's reminiscent of scenes from the radical riots in Paris precisely a year prior. It's a perfect perch for a group of about 40 to launch volleys of rocks and bricks on approaching police, who are twice driven back until they finally overrun the rampart. Police draw blood and sometimes their weapons. One officer brandishes his revolver at students who briefly have him cornered. Another puts his gun to the head of an arrestee. A third throws a rock through a window at the Mifflin Co-op. The crowd blocks Bassett Street with material from a pipe-laying project and sets trash fires. When police vehicles knock the burning barricades down, they're set back up, just to be knocked down again. By the time Soglin returns about 9 p.m., his ward looks like a war zone, with clouds of tear gas visible from blocks away. When he calls for calm over a squad car loudspeaker, a rock crashes through the windshield, splattering him with glass. After a brief lull, the chaos resumes and spreads to State Street. An uneasy calm finally comes about 12:30 Sunday morning. It does not last long. Police have made 25 arrests, 15 policemen and 13 youths are injured. The most serious injury is to a policeman, who suffers broken ribs from being hit by a brick. Police Chief Emery, who doesn't arrive until 8:30 p.m., later tells a mayoral commission investigating the riot that he, quote, "couldn't think of any different tactics to take other than what was being done." Detective McCarthy thinks it went well. "We went down there and bombed the shit out of them," he says later. The troubles are not over. And that's this week's Madison in the 60s. For your award-winning, listener-supported WORT news team, I'm Stu Levitan.
And that's it for our show. Thanks for listening to WORT's live local news at 6. Our headline writer this evening was Greg Sanderson. Our reporter was David Aaron. Special thanks to featured contributors Riley Cutright and Stu Levitan. Katie Giorgella is our on-air engineer on Wednesdays. Faye Parks is the producer of the newscast, and Charlie Pittman is the news director at WORT. I'm your host, Robert McClure.
And I'm your host, Amy Owen. Stay up to date with the WORT local news podcast. Subscribe on iTunes Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever else you get your podcasts. Up next is Query, followed by This Way Out. Good night.
Attention. Attention WORT volunteers and donors. WORT is holding an election for 2 open participating member seats and 1 open listener sponsor seat to serve 3-year terms on the board of directors of Back Porch Radio Broadcasting, Inc., with terms beginning at the annual meeting in June and concluding at the annual meeting in June 2027. Financial acumen, computer literacy, and a willingness to work within a dynamic group to help shape this great station are all desirable qualifications. People of underrepresented groups are strongly encouraged to apply. Some committee hours are required outside of board meetings. Applications must be received by 5 p.m. on Wednesday, May 15th to ensure consideration. Voting begins Thursday, May 30th and continues until the annual meeting on Sunday, June 30th. More information and board applications are available at WORTFM.org or on paper in the station lobby. Help us keep WORT a vibrant and important part of our community. Apply today.
The following program is syndicated. Please excuse any dated references. You're listening to WORT Madison.
There's no wrong death. If you're there, that's enough. Don't worry that you did something wrong. And I think that's a beautiful idea.
Hello and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast featuring authors from the American West and beyond. The Right Question is supported in part by Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio, and by the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans. I'm Lauren Korn, speaking with poet Melissa Kwasny, author of The Cloud Path, a collection that reckons with grief and recovery. At the heart of this collection is Melissa's mother's passing, the caretaking, the sick and deathbed rituals, her mother's after. Meanwhile, the world is in the midst of the COVID-19 pandemic, and the